Welcome to episode 57 of Meenal's World. Thank you all for joining me again this week, and thank you for all the love and messages that I received after my episode with George Monbiot. I'm glad you enjoyed it as much as I did. This week, I had the pleasure to sit down with Dipti Gurdasani. She is an epidemiologist who's worked tirelessly over the last couple of years to get facts and data out to the British public. We discussed her upbringing in Dubai and how going to medical school was a very difficult time for her, but how all of those experiences shaped her to being the person she is today. If you are listening to this on iTunes, please do leave a review. And if you are on any other podcast app, please do subscribe. It will really help us reach out to more people. Welcome to the show, Dipti. It's so lovely to finally get to meet you in person. And I've always wanted to see your lovely, beautiful backgrounds that I always see on, on TV. So I finally get to see it now.
Well, no, thank you for having me.
Dipti, I know it's been a very busy couple of years for everybody. And I know that you in particular have had you've had a very interesting 2 years. How are you feeling now at this stage of the pandemic? Because I was just thinking about it this morning. It almost feels like it was forever ago when the pandemic started, but at the same time, it also feels like it was just yesterday. So it's been a very testing time for all of us. How are you feeling now?
To be honest, I think I feel quite exhausted because I think, you know, for a long time, I felt a lot of hope that, you know, the way things were happening would change, but they've sort of deviated more and more from my expectations, I guess. And I probably, well, I don't want to start on this note, but I probably feel less hopeful now than I did at the beginning, which I didn't expect would be the case. It's certainly been quite a mentally exhausting period. And I have to say it's not been easy, and it's not gotten easy over time.
I think that I had a sense of naivety as well when the pandemic had started, and I was also quite hopeful. It was almost like a no-brainer that we're in a developed country with access to a lot of information, a lot of great scientists behind us as well to get the country through the pandemic. And there was a lot of naivety in me believing that things would be okay. And I think that does come from my upbringing, because where I was born and raised in Gibraltar, things were quite good. You know, I never really understood the depth of racism that people face in the world, for example, or the systemic inequalities that people have to face in different countries. What was it like for you, Dipti, growing up? Did you have that naivety as well, that the world can always be a better place? Or do you think that changed when you moved here?
I think it was always a sort of odd combination of cynicism and idealism. I was always a little bit depressed about the state of the world, but always expected more, you know. I grew up in Dubai as a non-resident Indian. Dubai is a sort of a funny place to sort of grow up. It's a very tiered society. Again, lots of misogyny and racism. And, you know, despite having been born there and spent my entire, childhood there, you know, we never get citizenship because that's how society there works. And then I moved to India, did medical schooling there, which was another cultural shock. I went to South India, and as a North Indian and as a person who never lived in India, it was a very, very different experience. And on top of that, I was doing medicine, which was a very, very different experience, which directly exposes you to the huge impacts of health disparities on people. And I think I wasn't prepared for that, because I have been largely sheltered all my life from all of that, having been brought up in a rather privileged family and protected from all that by my parents. Medical school was a shocker, and that might probably explain why, after qualifying in internal medicine, I was quite burnt out and decided that I actually wanted to leave medicine and do something else. Because, you know, while I think I was fairly good at it, I think the grief of dealing with that sort of impact on people that often feels quite random and unfair was, for me, it was too much. And I have a lot of respect and admiration for people who take that on a day-to-day basis. I mean, people like you, because I don't think people realize the huge toll it takes on you.
Yeah, I
I mean, I didn't realize either until we actually spoke about it during the pandemic, because before that, doctors would probably speak about it between doctors, but it was never a national conversation like it is now. And it's allowed me to look deeper into how I feel when I go into work and when I come up after a very difficult day. But you're right. I think I have a very similar upbringing to you, where I was quite sheltered and then I was exposed to the realities of the world, like just thrown straight into the deep end. And then you're like, wait, this is not what I expected things to be. I studied medicine in Prague. So I was flown over to some part of Europe to spend 6 years to get a medical degree. And it was interesting because it opened up my eyes to a different side of society that I didn't know existed. So I thought that was really important. And I see it as a blessing, Dipti, that we were sort of thrown into the deep end and taken away from that comfort zone.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly gives you a pretty diverse perspective to life. I mean, you know, often when I hear about, you know, people saying, you know, I haven't seen anyone affected by COVID or long COVID and things like that. And, you know, people saying, you know, it can't be that bad. It's like the flu. I often think that you have a different perspective when you've seen the impacts of, you know, infectious diseases and well, illnesses in general on people. And when you've seen, you know, young people die, you know, of illnesses in the shocking way, you sort of realize, you sort of learn to respect nature, I think, and you no longer feel this sense of security or immunity, I think, that many people have, that it can't happen to you because it's such a bad thing, and bad things don't happen to people because actually they do. And I think in medicine, you're very, very exposed to all the bad things that happen to people, and you start realizing that there is no force shield protecting anyone, and that, you know, it could happen to anyone. And I think that gave me a different perspective. I think you have to balance that against the trauma, which I'm still dealing with. But, you know, I feel terrible for the healthcare workers exposed to, you know, everything that they are exposed to now. I think when I was in medicine, I didn't realize how traumatic it was until after I left. And it's taken me over a decade to process the trauma from that. And I really worry about the healthcare workers going through the sort of disaster medicine that's happening now, because often you're in survival mode when it happens and the impact hits you many, many years later, and processing it, you know, can, well, I think you're never the same person again.
Dipti, how did your parents end up in Dubai, or why were you raised over there?
I think at that point in time, so in the 1970s, my parents moved to Dubai. A lot of Indians were moving there for sort of their idea of a better life, so a better lifestyle and things like that. It was this sort of glamorous place where people could have a better standard of living. I mean, it came with its plus and minuses, and certainly I think the standards of living were possibly higher, and we were sheltered from a lot of the sort of random chaos in India that I experienced later. But you know, it also felt like we were in a place where we were sort of second-class citizens, discriminated against. And it was a city that I have to say was a lot of glamour, but no soul. And I think when I came to India, I kind of found that soul, alongside, of course, the pain of witnessing, the huge impacts on people because of poverty. So I think, but it was sort of, I guess my childhood is very much being sheltered from reality because, you know, there is, you're very disconnected from reality in a place like Dubai. But, you know, doing medicine in India and doing it in sort of a rural area, which is quite deprived, I think exposed me to, a lot of reality for a lot of people, which I wouldn't have been otherwise. So I'm quite grateful for that.
What made you find the soul of India, Dipti? That's something that I find quite interesting, because for me, it really is as soon as I step out the aeroplane, that even just the smell of the air, for me, I know that it's India. And just walking through the streets, you just can hear the music and all the eclectic sounds of, you know, Delhi, for example, which is where I go to. Yeah. But what made you find the soul of the country when you were there?
I think it's all of those things, isn't it? It's the culture, it's the noise, the color. I mean, one of the things when I moved here was it was so quiet and everybody was wearing gray and black.
and the sky was also gray and black.
Yeah. You know, the noise, the color. Yeah, all of that. And the smell. Yeah, you're right. I mean, all of that kind of, and the food. Yeah. I do kind of miss some of that, but I mean, the place where I studied, well, like many other places in India, was also, well, deeply misogynistic. And it was difficult finding my feet as quite an independent woman. and I really, really struggled even in that setup. Well, as I have subsequently pretty much in every other setup. But, you know, medicine in India is a deeply, and I think, well, a lot of probably institutions, a lot of jobs in India have that underlying misogyny. I mean, misogyny is a very normalized and entrenched. And that was one of the reasons I really felt that I couldn't live there long term, because in many ways, you know, it was suffocating. And I felt like I was constantly fighting against it.
You mentioned that you live, you know, you had quite a sheltered childhood. And when you went to India, things changed quite a lot for you. Now, I assume you didn't have the emotional toolkit to deal with everything that was happening. So when you had bad days at university, when you were really struggling, what allowed you to escape it or heal from that?
So I had huge problems adjusting. There's no doubt about that. I didn't have a toolkit. I think I got very, very depressed in my first year in medical school. I was very isolated. I wasn't very good at making friends or socializing with people. That was one of the skills I didn't develop while growing up in Dubai. The way I dealt with it was I made a few close friends, and that really, really helped. Like-minded people, music really, really helped. But I also did see a therapist who I continued to see actually until I left medical school. And she is someone who I'm immensely grateful to. And actually, she attended my wedding and spoke at it years later and became a close friend. So yeah, a lot of people helped me adjust and get out of the pretty dark place I was in initially.
And do you think this dark place had anything to do with, was it all just related to the things that you were seeing in medical school and in the hospital and the difficulties you were facing being at university? Or do you think it came from an underlying trauma from your childhood or from anything that you'd seen before?
I think it was a combination of factors. I mean, certainly my childhood had a lot to do with it. I mean, I find it quite hard to describe my childhood to anyone because I think to most people it'd be sort of unbelievable. But we grew up in a pretty sort of isolated environment. My parents were very protective and probably not very progressive, which means that the only people that I was exposed to during the first 17 years of my life were probably cousins. You know, we had no friends. We had no social life. We weren't actually allowed to go out on our own. And what can I say? We were very privileged in that we had money, we had books, but I think in some ways we were sort of emotionally not very intelligent and quite deprived. Kind of moving to the real world with that sort of background meant that I certainly didn't have the tools to, to be resilient, to find help and to make connections with people, which actually I have to say for the rest of my life became one of the most important parts of my life, the connections that I've made. And I think I desperately wanted to make those connections, but just didn't have the tools to do it because of my upbringing. And I think that's what friends and going through therapy did for me. It really helped me understand myself and the legacy of the childhood that I'd had, and, you know, how it had led to me being really underconfident and, you know, had affected my self-esteem to the point that I didn't think that anybody would find it worthwhile engaging with me. And I think getting past that for me was critical to making relationships with people, which I think were healing in themselves.
I do also think, Vipti, that this kind of healing is something that can take a lifetime. You know, I mean, now as you're working past your medical degree and your PhD, and even with myself as a doctor, and I've got a little baby as well and married, and I'm thinking about things from the age of like 6 and 7, which I never thought about. And I think it's because I'm seeing Radhika grow up. I'm seeing my life through her as well. So it's almost like you bring back more trauma as you grow up, but you have more of the tools to heal from that, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think it blindsides you sometimes when you see something in your life and you think back to why you might be responding in this particular way. And then you're reminded of something that happened in your childhood. I mean, certainly when I had my daughter, I really, really struggled. I mean, I was one of those people who felt, well, very little sort of maternal instinct before having a child. And I wasn't really sure, was very ambivalent about whether I wanted a child. And when I had my daughter, I had no idea how you bond with a child, because partly because I feel like I didn't have any models of that from my own childhood. And it didn't happen for me initially. It didn't happen for years. Although, you know, I was desperate to shield her and protect her, what I considered as loving and bonding, it didn't come naturally to me. Partly because I didn't think, I overthought, and I didn't know what it should look like. And I wasn't very confident with her at all. But yeah, I mean, I have to say, it's amazing how far, you know, that sort of, I guess, early development goes, which is part of the reason I was terrified of having a child.
Yeah, it's almost like we don't want to ruin anything that we touch. It's like,
yeah.
What's your relationship now with your own parents, Dipti? Because I feel that as I've grown up and I've had, you know, I got married, had a baby, I'm much more open to talking about things. My parents are definitely not comfortable talking about a lot of things. But I'm definitely more confident to at least approach them and speak about things. And I'm really trying to open up a lot of windows for them, not just for me, but also for them, because I also know that they need to heal from a lot of their past, and their past is way more traumatic than ours is probably. So what's your relationship with your parents now?
I think, you know, that there is definitely some healing, you know, that's happened over time. But it's been difficult, because, I mean, I think, early on, when I started discovering parts of myself, I wanted to share it with them. But I think it was hard to do, because part of it would make them feel like they didn't do enough for me, which I didn't really want them to feel. But at the same time, it was important for me to communicate the places where I'd felt let down. And it's been a very, very difficult journey. And I think I've reached the point where I think now I feel like I'm in a place where I have acknowledged and validated those things for myself to the extent that I feel like I don't need someone else to, you know, and I'm okay with leaving it where it is, and listening to them and where they're coming from. And even when it hurts, I think I now see them as sort of people who are imperfect. Whereas I think when you're younger, you look at them as parents and people who need to be do perfectly by you. Whereas now, you know, like you say, thinking about their histories and their trauma, you understand the people, they are better, and you see them with all their flaws and sort of, you know, love them as just regular people rather than people you put on a platform. And I think that's been a very, very long process for me, but I think it's been worth it.
Yeah, wow. That's a very interesting take, Dipti, to understand that they're not perfect. I think even now when Radhika looks at me sometimes, she's probably looking at me thinking, my mommy can do everything. And I had a chat with one of my friends, Jaspreet Kaur. She's an author and she's a poet. And she was saying how one of the things that she wants to take forward with her own family is that it's okay to sort of open up to your children. If I have a bad day, for example, when Radhika can communicate and understand, I want to tell her, like, Radhika, mommy's had a difficult day today and I'm feeling like this because of whatever. And I think that's something that's going to take a lot of time for me to practice and develop, because I've never seen it around me before. But I really hope I can do her justice. And I feel like there's always this big cloud saying, you know, don't fuck this up. You know, like, but yeah, I think there's also that beauty of breaking that cycle. And I hope that I can do my best for Radhika, and that's what we can do, maybe.
I'm sure you will, just because you care so much. I mean,
we all do, you know. Dipti, we all do. And I think that you can care as much as you want, but it will never feel like it's enough.
Well, you know, my husband always says, and I think I agree with him on this, that, you know, you shouldn't be too perfect as a parent. You should be a little bit imperfect. And that's the ideal parent for your child, because, you know, they've got to see your imperfections. They have to understand your flaws. And they also have to, I guess, be able to develop an amount of resilience for themselves. You know, if you take away all their pain and anxiety, they'll never learn to do that themselves. So you need to be there for sure. They need to know there's this person to land on, you know, if things go fair-shaped. And, you know, that someone who loves them. I think more than anything, they need to feel loved unconditionally. But I think once they have that, you don't need to get everything right. I think, yeah, you just need to be, I think, what do I say? That slightly negligent parenthood, you know? You're not absolutely perfect, but, you know, make those mistakes once in a while so that they know that you're flawed.
You know what, I'm thinking, Dipti, yeah. when our daughters listen to this in 10 years' time, they're going to think, well, is that what my mommy really said? but Dipti, how did you meet your husband? Is he in the medical field as well?
Yeah, I actually met him in medical school, bizarrely, because of my very, very bizarre childhood. He was the first man that I met at age 17.
Wow.
So when you have a bizarre upbringing, things like that happen. I mean, he became a very, very close friend, and I probably knew him for more than a decade before we got married. And we developed a really, really close relationship. So I think we were friends more than anything, you know, and companions before we got married. And he's probably the person that I'm closest to now. And I'm really, really, really feel lucky to have him. Wow. Life's been a much better journey for having him around.
Oh, that's really sweet, Dipti. And was your marriage something that was easy to go through? Was that process okay, or were there any sort of obstacles or hurdles when you told your parents that this is the man I want to marry?
Oh gosh, it was terrible.
do I need to record another podcast just for this story, Dipti?
Yeah, probably, but in very brief, for people who are not very aware of sort of Indian culture, I came from a family that from a Hindu background, although I was an atheist, and my husband is an atheist as well, but he came from a family from a Muslim background. And, you know, Hindu and Muslim families coming together in marriage is not a thing that is considered terribly positive in India. And, you know, given that, well, my family has a lot of Hindu nationalists on its side.
Oh, wow. It was, I can't imagine how that goes, Dipti.
Oh, gosh.
Do you have a separate Twitter profile just for that?
Thankfully not. I've avoided anything to do with it. Yeah. But I have to say, the people on my my dad's side were probably very, very unhappy. I can't say that my family was terribly unhappy. I mean, they did agree to it finally, I guess because we were going to get married anyway, but it was a very, very scary few months in there.
Yeah,
and we were also worried about security and things like that, because you do have to worry about that in India. We got married in Delhi, so you know, you can imagine the stress around that. It wasn't easy, and I'm still often reminded about the fact that I could have married anyone else, and why did I have to choose someone from a Muslim family? So it continues even after you have a child. Yeah,
I mean, even with us as well, with Nishanta and I, we had a few hiccups along the way. He's Brahmin, and to be honest, I don't really know what caste we are, because we basically come from Delhi. My dad was born in the slums of Delhi, and he was probably right at the bottom of that whole pyramid. But you know, Nishant's family were very keen on a Brahmin Gujarati girl. Punjabi, he's Gujarati. And there was a lot of hiccups along the way, and finally everything happened. And we had a lovely wedding. We had a beautiful wedding in the sunshine in Malaga in Spain. But even now, when Radhika's almost two, people are still talking about it. And I'm like, even, you know, we have children now. We've definitely moved on from that. But it almost feels like, I do think sometimes our parents and our families want something to complain about.
Yeah, I mean, that does certainly seem to be the case.
Because I'm just like, move on with your life. There's so much more to enjoy. Like, Radhika's so cute and she's growing up. Let's talk about that. I feel like there's a sense of, we have to suffer all the time, and we have to, you know, fight something. There's, because our families have suffered so much, they think that's the normal, and they can't let go of that that sense and just say, you know what, it's just time to enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've noticed in our family is that there's a lot of focus on, well, there's a lot of classism, there's a lot of social signals and stigmas, and everything seems to revolve around that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you've your parents or your family has sat and watched these really dramatized soap operas that you tend to see on Indian television. And it almost feels like their life imitates art, if you would call that art. I wouldn't. But, you know, it seems like there is constantly drama happening and it's almost engineered. And it's something that I found very, very hard, to the point that I hate any sort of drama now about anything. It really, really irritates me, you know. So even when things are really, really bad, I just want no drama in my life. But I think drama is very much part of our, almost part of our culture in North India. At least I feel that in our family. And it's really, really hard to deal with because a lot of it is irrational, illogical, and creates a lot of strife among people and relationships. And sometimes I feel like a little more emotional maturity and understanding would go a long way.
So Dipti, once you came to Cambridge, were you married at this point or did this happen after?
No, I wasn't married the first year I was here. We got married the second year after I came here, after I completed my master's in epidemiology. So I came here as a student to do my master's, and then we got married the next year. But, you know, I had a great time in Cambridge my first year.
Yeah, what was it like after your really difficult time in India, as you'd mentioned?
Yeah.
And then you had your counselling and your therapy. I'm sure that that must have helped you to some extent to come to the UK now. Not only coming to a different place, and Cambridge is very beautiful, but also just sort of being not just physically far away, but also emotionally being able to just separate yourself from everything. What was that like?
It was great. I mean, well, it was mixed rather than great, but in some ways it was great because initially...
I love how you always start off like everything is great, but...
But yeah, well, that's the story of my life. I'm the best. Yeah. I think it was a very strange experience. I mean, you as a medic would probably recognize this. When you've been a clinician for years and years and your whole life has been seeing patients and you're suddenly separated from that and you're doing something else. So I was training for this epidemiology course, you know, so I was back to attending classes as a student, which I hadn't done for a really long time. And I wasn't seeing patients, you know, and it was a bit of an identity crisis, because I think as a medic, so much of your identity is mixed in with being a doctor, that when you stop doing it, it feels like a bit of a shock. It feels like, I don't know who I am and I don't know what use I am to anybody. But I think that space was essential for me because it helped me sort of discover that I didn't want to do medicine anymore. And as I got delved more and more into epidemiology, it gave me the space to recognize that I would be okay if I sort of let medicine go and actually follow a career in something else. So it was necessary space, which was initially painful, but I think it was very, very good that I had that year to sort of clear my mind and not have any patient contact and figure out what I wanted to do next.
Was there any reason you wanted to specifically study epidemiology?
Yes. I mean, I think like many, many Indian children, I ended up doing medicine largely because my parents wanted me to, my
join
mom
the club.
Particularly. So I actually got into engineering and medicine. And I think because I felt that my parents would be happier if I did take up medicine, my dad is a GP as well, now retired. I kind of did it. And during medicine, I mean, I definitely wasn't bad at it, but I do think that it took its emotional toll on me. And I don't think I was well suited to it. Someone with, I think my personality wasn't well suited to it. And before that in school, the things that I was most passionate about were things like math and physics. So biology was probably the thing I was least passionate about. So in medical school, I think the area that appealed to me most, I guess that was most sort of statistically or mathematically connected, was epidemiology, which is why I then did a course in epidemiology. And as I did more and more of it, I realized that actually I wanted to move to more mathematical fields. And, and also perhaps not see patients again, because I was very, very traumatized by the whole experience in medicine. I think if you are doing medicine, and I wish that somebody had told me this before I joined medicine, I think if you're the sort of person who cannot separate other people's emotional pain from yourself and cannot deal with the grief of losing patients or you know, talking to their relatives, you probably shouldn't be a doctor. It's not something that I think you can train yourself to an extent. That sort of training was not available to us. We were just thrown into the deep end. But I think there is also a personality factor. I think there are some people who will never be able to deal with it and who will always be traumatized. I think I was one of those people. And I probably should have never done medicine. But now I kind of feel like it gives me that sort of broader perspective on what I do, having had that experience. And at the same time, I can pursue areas that probably I should have pursued earlier on in life that I had a better aptitude for.
Mm. So Dipti, after you did your course at Cambridge, did you immediately go into the Sangha Institute or did you have a break in between?
No, I didn't really have a break. I straight went into doing a PhD at the University of Cambridge. And while I was doing my PhD at Cambridge, I was actually based at Sangha. And, you know, I continued from there, doing my postdoctoral research there, becoming a senior scientist there, right until the end when I was dismissed. I was there for about 9 years. And a lot of that period was actually really, really good.
What was it like in that time over there? Because to come from Dubai in India, then to come to the UK and work in an institution where you think there would be less misogyny, you know, less discrimination. Did you face any of that when you were working here in the UK at the very start of your career?
So when I was a PhD student, it certainly didn't feel like it. I was also less aware of these things back then. So if there was all of that, I think it's very likely I would have missed at least some of it because, you know, as you come here as an immigrant, you're just grateful. I think that, you know, you've ended up in a place that you wanted to be, that you're learning what you want to learn. I was grateful. I was very, very grateful for the opportunities provided to me, although I had earned every single one of them.
I'm really glad you said that really proudly, Dipti, because a lot of us are very afraid to say that, especially as South Asian women. We think that we should owe it to somebody else who gave us an opportunity. But that's really empowering that you said that, Dipti. Well done.
Well, I mean, I kind of think the people who gave me the opportunity didn't do it altruistically. They got more than, you know, their pound of gold for it. But I think as I moved into more and more senior positions, it became more and more visible to me, both at Cambridge and at Sangha. I could see it in, you know, I could see the discrimination, the misogyny, the racism that was sort of really entrenched to the point was normalized so that, you know, if you, I guess, internalize it, you almost wouldn't see it. But when people brought it up or when you noticed it, then you couldn't not see it. And I mean, that's when I guess I started really, really struggling with the UK academic culture because it wasn't just a Sangha, it wasn't just Cambridge. I mean, I've subsequently, after having many, many years to think about it, realized that Sangha wasn't the exception. It was very much the rule. And, you know, at Sangha, 12 of us got together and put together a whistleblowing complaint about many different aspects. It included bullying, gender discrimination, financial misconduct, unethical use of samples and data. And the process of going through that sort of complaints process, the investigation, it was absolutely horrific. And I think it really opened my eyes to something that I was very naive about before, which is the power gradients that you have in academia and how they always will protect the people who are most privileged, regardless of competence, regardless of ethics, regardless of morals, and regardless of fault or responsibility. And I struggled there for 2 years trying to get justice. Justice for communities within Africa who had very kindly contributed their samples to research that were misused without consent by the Sangha. And at the end of that long process, where I was also bullied and intimidated as a junior researcher by very, very senior people at the Institute, I was finally dismissed for gross misconduct, bringing the Institute into disrepute. My big crime was writing a private email to collaborators saying that I had been bullied at the Sangha, which apparently was seen as bringing the Institute into disrepute.
Wow. How did they get hold of these emails?
Good question. I have to say, I don't know to date, but I think somebody on that thread forwarded it to somebody at Sangha.
So you were facing this discrimination and you wanted to speak up about it, and other people around you felt the same. So you tried to make a change. And what was that process that you, what was it, what were the initial steps you took to create a change? Was it a lawsuit? Was it just speaking to your bosses? What was that process like?
So I think the initial process was just talking to each other, talking to people who had also suffered similar or different types of detriment at the Institute, who had been victimized with complaining or who had been sort of pushed out of the Institute because of gender discrimination. Other people who had intellectual property stolen had been bullied out. Getting together and essentially putting together a complaint, which took a while. And this was a 500-page document with all the evidence, all the receipts, very, very thoroughly done, that we then submitted. And even before we submitted it, I mean, we were victimized pretty badly because essentially, you know, we were pushed to try and have some sort of internal resolution with this person who was responsible, because we were told that if we didn't, we wouldn't be allowed to hire any staff. So a lot of our other research was essentially being put on hold to try and, I guess, prevent us from going to external channels and try and resolve this internally. Of course, the internal resolution was never going to be a fair resolution, because actually the external resolution wasn't either. Because what we learned through the process is that none of these systems are independent, and certainly, I mean, human resources was completely complicit in the whole thing. I mean, in the end, my complaint was actually made about the head of human resources and about the chief operating officer. And I was told that my complaint would be investigated by two people that were managed by both of them.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, the system was so flawed and it was so corrupt that, you know, I had absolutely no hope that we would get justice to the system. And we didn't. I mean, we had 9 team members, all of whom were either terminated, dismissed, or made redundant in the end. So our entire team massively suffered. They were given very, very short notice. Well, here we are now, all of us in different places. Yeah.
Well, Deepthi, you mentioned that you came from a very sheltered background and you weren't someone who spoke up much, you weren't very sociable. So to go from that kind of Deepthi to the Deepthi at the Sangha Institute, speaking up against this discrimination, where do you think that force came from?
So I think since I was a child, I was very shy. I wasn't terribly outspoken, but I always saw myself as a bit of a rebel. So it was weird. I was a weird combination of low self-esteem, but outrage and rebelliousness. It was very, very odd. So I think biologically, I'm probably somebody who if I think I had a lot more confidence growing up, I would have been a lot more outspoken. But I think that sort of moral injury and this idea, like I said earlier on, I was cynical and idealistic, which was the most bizarre combination. So I expected more from people. I expected more from the world. I expected that there should be justice, that things should be put right. And I think that was extremely naive point of view, but I think that sort of, I think pushed me to do all of this, because there was a sense of moral injury that people shouldn't be allowed to get away with doing this. And particularly when there are such power gradients involved. I mean, these are essentially, this is an institute that gets, what, 300 million every 5 years, you know, run by privileged white men, you know, who are essentially misusing unethically data and samples from African communities. I mean, that sort of thing, it's just very hard to swallow. I mean, I often look back and think, Deepthi, having known everything you know, would you go through it again? And I think that, you know, I had this naive idea that we could achieve justice, and I certainly don't have that now. So I think now, if I had gone through it, I would have realized that we had no chance of getting any sort of apology or acknowledgement for what happened. But I think I also couldn't have done it any other way, because if I hadn't spoken up, I would have been complicit, because they were going ahead with this thing anyway. And if I hadn't spoken up, I would have become part of the process, which is something I just couldn't have done. But you know, if I had to do things differently, I think I would have quit of my own accord rather than have them dismiss me, which was a very, very painful process after having served at the Institute for 9 years. They had security escort me to my appeal hearing after having been there for 9 years. It was, I never thought any in my life that anything like that would happen to me. I mean, I'm not a security risk to anyone. I've never been. My daughter was at the nursery at Sangha since she was born. I mean, I spent almost a decade there, but it was probably an intimidation tactic, but they got security to escort me to my appeal hearing. They removed access from my cart without having a meeting with me. I couldn't actually go and drop my daughter off to her crèche. It was a very, very difficult few years.
How old was your daughter at that time?
She was very young. She was 3. And I remember writing this email, an open letter actually, to our faculty saying how much this had an impact, you know, on me and my family and the toxic culture that had been created. And I was really worried that it would perpetuate itself because nobody seemed to be really challenging it. And the fact that it had robbed me of years of my daughter's life, because I think, you know, when you're going through something like that, the trauma is so intense. I mean, I remember sitting next to my daughter, you know, reading her a bedtime story and just bursting into tears, you know. Oh. I remember having thoughts of killing myself, but you know, I couldn't do it because of my daughter, because I mean, this is what you don't realize when you have a kid, you can't even commit suicide, you know, because you can't do that to somebody. So it was very, very hard. And what I really, really feel terrible about is having lost those years with her, because I really wasn't there mentally, you know.
You're telling me this and I'm actually tearing up, because last year when we went through the process of a legal case, and Radhika was, I mean, she was just a newborn when we were still going through the process, and there was so much back and forth. And I was fed up with everything, thinking, can we just put an end to this pain? Because yes, we want justice. And for us, it just seems so simple that all you have to do is just change a few things in the system. All you have to do is just say, look, put your hands up, we made a mistake, and move on. Yeah. Like, it's really that easy. But people are so stubborn, and the system is so, you know, it's so inflexible. It doesn't want to change. And I never thought about it in this way, but it did also rob me time of Radhika and precious time with her, because when I was out for walks with her, I mean, even before I went into my cesarean section, I still remember replying to an email from my lawyer saying, I'll get back to you in the next 48 hours. I'm just about to give birth.
Gosh.
You know, so I never thought about it that way. And it must have been a terribly difficult time, but was there any outcome from that at all? Any positive outcome?
Yeah, I did launch a case against them for detriment as a result of whistleblowing, because, I mean, technically you're not allowed to dismiss somebody for whistleblowing. So I was fighting the case on the basis that when they fired me for, you know, gross misconduct, because I wrote that email saying I was being bullied, it was because I had whistleblowed. I was very naive about it, which is probably why I launched the case. And by the time that I submitted the documents to tribunal, I had spent £28,000 of my own money, which I was paying off in installments every month because I didn't even have the money. So I was in debt. At which point in time, my lawyers told me that they wanted me to pay another £10,000 for them to assess the probability of me winning. And then it would be another £50,000, £200,000 to go through tribunal. And the thing is, what people don't realize is for tribunal cases, even if you win, you don't get your legal fees paid back. What you get is damages, which for me would have been about 1 month of salary, because I soon got a job somewhere else, you know? So I would have not even been paid a tiny fraction of the money that I was spending. So literally, if I had won, it would just be a spending about £100,000, which I didn't have, for a moral victory. Mm-hmm. And it was taking a huge toll on me mentally. So I ultimately pulled the case because I just didn't have the money to continue with it. And, you know, that's another thing that I didn't know, because I think a lot of people have the sense of security that, you know, people can't fire me, people can't do this because it's illegal. The truth is, it's only illegal if you have the resources to fight people in court. I was up against an organization that could have spent millions on this case without blinking twice. So nobody was paying out of pocket. And what people don't understand is the huge financial gradients that create power gradients. And they're very good statistics that if you don't have lawyers representing your case and you do it yourself, your chance of winning is pretty minuscule. So money matters a lot in these cases. And I just ran out of money. And I spent the next year or so paying off my debt to my lawyers.
And you had a baby at home who obviously you needed to take care of. That's just, wow. What did your family think about all of this at that time? And I ask you, Bithi, because I feel that when I went out, when I did my first protest in April, I probably decided 4 or 5 days before that I was going to do this. And I said, look, at that time, I was pregnant. I was about 6 months pregnant, but nobody in India knew about me being pregnant. And actually nobody knew apart from our close family, friends. But then Nishan made a good point that if you're out there protesting, telling people I'm pregnant and I'm working in the hospital, people are going to find out. And for me, the biggest burden of that whole protest wasn't, oh, I'm going to get arrested or my GMC license. It had nothing to do with that. It was, what do I tell my family? Because it was such a it's crazy when I say it out loud. But for me to go out and speak up against the British establishment as a South Asian woman who's also pregnant from Gibraltar, it was just so far-fetched. Like nobody could even imagine that happening in our family and in Nishan's family as well. So to cut a long story short, people were very against it. Family members didn't agree with us. They said, look, you're actually putting your life on the line. But just like you, I couldn't be complicit. I didn't want to be that person where in 10 years when Radhika asks me, oh, mummy, what did you do in the pandemic? I couldn't have that sense to say, I didn't do anything. I have to do something. My parents didn't understand at that time. A lot of people in my family didn't understand. And I think to this day, I think they still don't really understand what we've done and why it was so important. But I think that cultural barrier for us actually makes it much more difficult for us to be an activist or for us to be speaking up to establishments and institutions.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely spot on. I mean, I think deference is very much part of Indian culture. You know, I mean, our parents, for example, if they face a difficult situation with their employer or whatever, the culture was very much you respect the hierarchy and you shut up, you know. So for them, it was really, really alien what I was doing. And they were terrified. And for them, I think I've always been the sort of, what do I say, a bit of a maverick child, you know, who doesn't really follow the expectations, which is why I went and married somebody they didn't want me to marry, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't unexpected, but there was a lot of, you know, why are you doing this? We're already scared for you. You need to, you know, just shut up, just keep quiet, get on with things. And, you know, you'll have a much better career. You'll have a much better life. I think they were absolutely right about the bit about if you shut up, you will have a better career. Yeah. But I guess, you know, I wasn't really looking for that. You know, I was kind of in that frame of mind looking for some sort of justice or so, yeah, I don't think they understood. I don't think they still understand. But I mean, they weren't necessarily supportive of what I was doing, but they were supportive when I was feeling really, really down in that, you know, maybe try and find other things to do. And I think that was vitally important. One of the other whistleblowers I became very, very close to also told me, it's very important that you have something else in your life and that this doesn't take over everything, because it can. It can take over your life. And if you don't start letting go at some point, it can really hurt you. It can really, really damage you as a person. I mean, I've seen, I think after the experience, I joined a voluntary group that supports Do Better Academia, that supports people who've been bullied, people who've been discriminated against in universities. And that's when I sort of started using my experience to try and help other people, because I realized that I could, I guess, see past what was happening in the system, because I was no longer had that naivety that these systems have follow their own processes or that they're meant to be independent or that, you know, there is any hope for justice. And I remember during that process becoming more and more sort of, I don't know, jaded by what was happening in academia and the power gradients in academia and how they were being used, particularly to victimize outspoken women or disabled women and women of color. And what I saw again and again was that, you know, this sort of trauma and seeking justice for it and not getting justice and the moral injury associated with it, it can destroy your life, you know. And at some point, although it's really, really painful, you have to let it go so that you can be present for the other people in your life and other aspects in your life. So I was sort of forced to do that. I never stopped fighting this anger thing publicly. I went and went public about my experience, which I think I should have done a lot earlier now. But, you know, I guess through trying to help other people and listening to their experiences, started healing, which enabled me to be more present for other people, rather get burnt by the fire internally, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, Dipti, once you left the Institute and you tried to put things behind you, then, so how long ago was that? Like, what was the time frame between that and COVID?
2019, I think end of June, they dismissed me. And then I started my job at Queen Mary's in, I think, August. So
just a few months before the pandemic hit, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm just a bit lost now. Was it in 2020, yeah. Right? When the pandemic
yeah,
hit?
Yeah.
Just it a was, few months, it, yeah. So you went,
it was just
so you
a
went,
few months.
So you went from that really difficult journey of speaking up to this establishment and speaking up to the system, to trying to reset your own life and trying to find yourself as a scientist and a researcher again, trying to reset it, putting a reset button on your career and your personal life. Then the pandemic comes along and you can see that things are not looking right. And you start speaking up on social media and you start telling people, like, this is, we really need to be worried about this. This is not going to work if we take these actions. And I was reading, I was listening to an interview by Christiane Amanpour, and she was talking about her journalism, and she was saying that her motto is truthful but never neutral. And I think that's a really powerful motto to have, even as a scientist, because maybe not in particularly in your situation, but we've had scientists working directly with the government, and they've been trying to fight themselves between what the science is saying and what the government actually wants. But I really believe that for you, it's just being about telling the truth and just putting everything you know out there. That in itself is a very emotional and emotionally taxing. So you went from one thing straight into the other. And how do you feel now? And going back to what I was saying about having that emotional toolkit, do you feel you were better prepared for the pandemic?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to say the Sanger experience and the experience of seeing, you know, how other people were bullied in other institutions and systems, and how, you know, there was a systemic sort of power gradient in society, and even Brexit. I mean, there's so many parallels between, you know, my micro scale Sanger experience and the macro scale Brexit experience, that you see the world differently. And I think that hugely helped me, massively lowered my expectations about, you know, what politicians or government would be willing to do and how the systems worked. And, you know, I had definitely just thanked the Sanger, because one of the reasons I joined social media was essentially talk about what was happening in the Sanger in 2017. So being in touch with people on Twitter was very much, serendipitous because of that. And I think when I saw what was happening in March, you know, when they were talking about sort of delaying any action because it was good for people to get infected, the herd immunity by infection strategy. I mean, I was outraged, because I could not believe at some level that this would happen in a country like that. And then listening to scientific advisors supporting this as well. But then having been through the Sanger experience, I had also a very good idea of how UK academia and scientific leadership works. I mean, that's when I started speaking up on social media, and I had very few followers, so it didn't really matter. It was just a way of, I guess, feeling like I was doing something, you know. And we also wrote a few papers early on about, you know, what we thought was a fallacy. And, you know, when people talk about scientists and politics and all that and being neutral and centrist, I don't understand what any of that means. I mean, when you're talking about science, it's, so science is evidence-based, right? I mean, there are facts out there. There's the interpretation of facts. And, you know, you get that across. What does neutral mean? I mean, neutral is a political term. Centrism is a political term because they're both relative to something. They're relative to something, right? But facts aren't relative. So I don't understand it when people tell me that I'm taking an extreme position or I'm not centrist or whatever, because I think all of those are relative positions, whereas science is about facts. You just convey the facts. I don't understand how you be neutral. And public health is inherently about understanding the big picture, about seeing what politicians are doing, what the political will is, understanding the social context. I mean, how can you ever dissect public health from all of that? I mean, and you shouldn't want to, because ultimately what you want is to be able to recommend things that help real people with all the structural barriers that you have in society, with social networks, with political networks, et cetera, et cetera. And you cannot do that by being the sort of purist that you need to follow some sort of basic science, because public health just isn't like that.
Mm. What's it been like over the last 2 years when you've had these difficult moments on Twitter or in social media, and then having to sort of switch off your laptop, turn around and then go to your daughter and read her a bedtime story? Because I've had those days with Radhika where I'm on a call or I'm trying to do something online and I switch my laptop and there's Radhika wanting a cuddle. And I have all of these things going through my head and I can't switch from, you know, scientist or doctor straight to mother within a click of a finger. So I find that part really difficult. Do you have any sort of tools that help you just sort of ground yourself and try to detach from it as quickly as possible?
I'm afraid I can't help there. I mean, there are points I have switched off.
I'm asking more for me, Dipti. This is not really.
No, I know. I have the same problem as well. I think the only points that I have been able to switch off are active breaks that I've taken, where I've taken time off and, you know, weeks off even, when I've had poor health or I've had to look after Lana. And I think that's been really, really great, actually, not having to have Twitter battles with people and having the trauma of seeing what people are putting out. I mean, the fact is that all the misinformation and all the minimization of Twitter, I mean, ultimately it affects you personally. It does. Because COVID is a pandemic and what happens out there affects your family. And for us, I mean, the impacts have been huge. I mean, you know, I think in many ways we are privileged, and I'm sure there are people who are far, far more impacted than us. But, you know, as a family that's a clinically vulnerable household, and as a person who's immunosuppressed and chronically ill and disabled, it's been very, very hard to essentially watch the devaluation of our lives. And knowing that when people talk about those acceptable deaths, they're talking about people like me. And I think it's very hard to separate yourself from that. And it does take a mental toll on you, because I have to say, I never felt clinically vulnerable before COVID, despite being on immunosuppression and despite having been chronically ill for years and years. I never felt the way I do now. I never felt scared. I never felt vulnerable in the way I do now, to be honest. Mm. And I never felt that society wouldn't care about me the way I do now. So, you know, it does affect you personally. And when your child is affected, that affects you personally as well. You know, it's impossible to separate yourself from those things. So, yeah, when I see people talking about kids not being impacted or, you know, kids not shouldn't be vaccinated, et cetera, et cetera, I think it goes a step beyond. I do feel that it affects me psychologically, and it's very hard to separate yourself from it as an individual.
Is your husband working as a doctor here in the UK now as well?
Yeah, he's a consultant psychiatrist, so he's been he's been a healthcare worker, key worker throughout the pandemic. And I think that's the other thing that people don't see, the huge impact on healthcare workers. And you know, things have been very, very hard for them as well, and their whole team. And the patient community that they serve. And of course, as a family, we deal with all of that, you know, all the impacts of COVID on in all those respects. And when people minimize those, it's very, very hard, given that you see them on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the conversations Nishant and I have had over the last 2 years has been about how unfair the world is. And even though we have Radhika in front of us a lot of the time, we're very lucky to have her. You know, Nishant sees, he's a GP, so he sees people, even just now, the people are saying, I have to choose either to feed myself or to keep my house warm because the bills have gone up. You know, just small things like that. It makes you reflect on the privileges we have, no matter how small or big they are. I also believe that being able to speak up or having even a platform, no matter how big or small, isn't a privilege in itself, and it should be used in the right way. Now, as a scientist, Deepthi, what role do you think we have as healthcare workers, more specifically in the NHS as well, and as a scientist like yourself working on these studies, what role do you think we have on our democracy? Because now when we look at the people who vote, it isn't just about, oh, what do their family vote for, or the kind of borough they live in, or the part of the UK they live in. It is a lot about the information they consume. And I feel that we play a role in providing that information. How important do you feel your work is in actually shaping people's views?
I think it's, I mean, I don't know about my work, but I think generally scientific communication in a pandemic is vitally important. I mean, you cannot expect people to make informed decisions about risk and how to protect themselves if they don't understand what the risks are. And I don't think we've ever communicated either the risks or the ways in which to protect ourselves against those risks very, very clearly. And the fact that these are always done at community level, not at individual level. I mean, none of these things have been communicated appropriately by a government, and often not by scientific advisors as well. And I mean, I think the unique thing about the COVID, well, I don't think it's actually unique, perhaps for people who've been following the disinformation around climate change and the tobacco industry. But one of the key features of the COVID pandemic has been that scientists themselves have been a source of misinformation. And it's not the vast majority of scientists, but it's a small number of scientists which appear like a majority because they're given platforms by media and have undue influence on government, despite having been wrong repeatedly, you know, and that's the really, really disappointing part, where you know that there is a global scientific consensus, but you don't see it being represented to the public. And you also don't see it informing policy. What you see is a fringe pseudoscientific view informing policy because it's convenient, and also being platformed by the media to then normalize what governments are doing. And I have to say, despite all my cynicism, I didn't think that it would be so bad. I didn't think that we would be living in a developed country where people were talking about COVID being like the flu at a point in time where people couldn't get emergency care for life-threatening conditions. And I didn't think we'd be living in a country that chose to expose the vast majority of children to infection and infected them rather than vaccinating them. So those are things that I didn't think that I would live to see, but well, here we are.
Well, Deepthi, this has been a fascinating conversation. I've always had a lot of respect for you, but after having spoken with you in the last hour, it's definitely amplified. And I'm so grateful to have the privilege to speak to someone who's worked so, so hard in the last 2 years, and that as well, mostly just from the goodness of your heart. So thank you for your time, Deepthi. I really do appreciate it.
Oh no, thank you for having me, and the respect is extremely mutual.
Thank you, Deepthi.
Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week. You can follow Deepthi on Twitter, where she's very active. I've left her Twitter handle in the show notes below. And as I said, if you are on iTunes or any other podcast app, please do subscribe and share with your friends and family. I'm sure more of us can learn from these conversations. As always, have a lovely week, and I'll see you next Friday with another guest.